This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for an interview with Greg Walkington, director of the Family Transition Project of the Arc of Illinois. But first, disability news for the week of November 18, 2024. President-elect Donald Trump has said he wants to eliminate the U.S. Department of Education, but there are different opinions on what that might mean for students with disabilities across the country. The question of how such a move might affect students in special education was discussed at a public briefing of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights last week. While discussing teacher shortages, Commissioner Mondaire Jones asked a panel of experts to address how closing the Department of Education could affect students with disabilities. Eric Hanishek, a fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University who specializes in the economics of education, said that the push to close the education department is political and wouldn't fundamentally alter special education. According to Hanishek, quote, "I don't think eliminating the Department of Education would do much. Congress is the one who decides on appropriations, and they would just redirect to when the executive branch is in charge of these appropriations, so that I don't think it has any obvious impacts on IDEA funding or other funding," end quote. William Trockman, general counsel at Mountain States Legal Foundation, a conservative public interest law firm, said that the implications will largely come down to details. Others, however, said the consequences of dismantling the education department could be dire for students with disabilities, particularly in terms of access and equity and the protection of civil rights. Amanda Levin Mazin, a senior lecturer at Columbia University's Teachers College, said, quote, "Without a large governing body, there's going to be no regulation on who gets what. So the disparities that already exist in educational opportunities for students, not only with disabilities, but students who are marginalized for other reasons, will be exacerbated. There will be no more guarantee of basic educational rights, which is really what IDEA, Title I, and other aspects of the Department of Education really provide," end quote. Levin Mazin also noted that the Education Department plays a large role in providing funding to colleges and universities to prepare special education teachers, and she worries that without the agency, the pipeline of qualified educators would be threatened. Robert Santos, director of the U.S. Census Bureau, has announced the agency will not make any changes to the way it counts the number of Americans with disabilities for at least 2 years after advocates' concerns that planned updates could lead to an undercount. Santos said, quote, "Beyond that, we'll consider the full breadth of what is the best fit for measuring this topic on the ACS. Nothing will change without continued engagement with and input from the disability community," end quote. The announcement came after census officials met with more than 100 disability community stakeholders in an attempt to address fallout after the agency proposed sweeping changes to its disability questions last year. Census officials plan to change the order and wording of the 6 disability questions in the American Community Survey while adding a new question about psychosocial and cognitive disability and problems with speech. Also, people would be asked to rate the level of difficulty they have with various functions rather than simply responding with yes or no. If implemented, advocates warn the change could lead to a 40% drop in the number of people considered to have disabilities, which would have broad implications since census data is a factor in determining federal funding allocations and decisions about many government programs. Scott Landis, an associated professor of sociology at Syracuse University who was involved in the meeting, said he remains worried that census officials have not ruled out eventually reverting to the proposed methodology, which he says severely underestimate the disability population. And finally, an independent federal agency is investigating how teacher shortages are impacting students with disabilities across the country. The U.S. Commission on Civil Rights held a briefing last week where it heard from government officials, current and former educators, researchers, and others who have been impacted. The commission is an independent, bipartisan federal agency that conducts investigations and produces reports for Congress and the president on key civil rights matters. Said Commissioner Stephen Gilchrist, quote, "Education is fundamental for every child, and it's our duty to ensure that students with disabilities are not only included, but empowered within our educational system. We must ensure that the resources, supports, and understanding they deserve are provided to ensure them and their parents the most favorable outcomes," end quote. Specifically, the commission said that it will examine the challenges that schools are experiencing filling openings for special education professionals and what the government is doing to address these issues. The investigation comes as special education enrollment has increased to a record high of 7.5 million, about 15% of all students. Also, data from the U.S. Department of Education's National Center for Education Statistics shows that 74% of elementary and middle schools and 66% of high schools reported difficulty finding fully certified teachers to fill special education teaching vacancies at the start of this academic year. In addition to the briefing last week, the commission is accepting public comment through December 16th to further inform its report. And that's the news for this week. I can see clearly now that the rain is gone. Well, I can see all obstacles in my way. Yeah, gone are the dark clouds that used to make me blind. Well, it's gonna be a bright. And you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. I'm happy to welcome my friend Greg Walkington, who is the director of the Family Transition Project of the Arc of Illinois, a really important project, and he does some great work. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being here.
So why don't you introduce yourself to the listeners first, and then we'll talk more about the project and some of the things that you've been working on.
So I am, as you said, the Family Transition Project Director for the Arc of Illinois, and my job responsibilities are to work with individuals that are in one of our 7 state-operated developmental centers, or also known as institutions, that might want to explore a transition back into the community to Ascilla or back home or back into where they grew up, into the community in which they grew up. Another important piece is that I am also a father of my fantastic daughter, Colette Walkington, who is 30 years old, has intellectual and developmental disabilities, as well as extremely medically fragile. Mm. So I not only do this personally, but I do it professionally. And I've been serving individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities in the state of Illinois for over 35 years.
Yeah, it's really great work that you do, Greg. And this project has been going on for a while now, has it not?
Yes, it has. We seem to be still sticking with the design of the state-operated developmental centers currently, and And until they're gone, I have a purpose to try to help people to get back into the community.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the ways that the Family Transition Project helps people to do that.
So first of all, I would be neglect if I didn't talk about a few other aspects of my job. Number one, if anyone is in danger of ending up back at an institution or at an institution, I also get involved. So they may be in the community having some health problems that are not allowing them to go back to their cella, perhaps ambulation issues, and they have stairs, just like might happen with one of our own family members, parents or something. As well as anyone that has recently transitioned out of the state-operated developmental center but might need some extra support. So I try to stay with people as long as they would like me involved in their case and in their transition, whether that be have not left yet and are having issues at a state institution and or at risk of ending up in an institution and or have recently transitioned into the community but might end up back in a state-operated developmental center. Does that make sense?
It makes complete sense. But what my question is, has the Family Transition Project been around long enough that people just know that you're there and they contact you? How does that work?
So it works in several different ways, yes. The Arc of Illinois is a fairly well-known name, and people will cold call us and ask if we can help. As well as every year at each individual's staffing or each individual's annual meeting, they are informed about the Arc of Illinois, they're informed about the transition process and the possibility, and then they ask both the guardian, if there is a guardian involved, and or the individual, is that something you would like to explore? And then I also provide a letter to the Department of Developmental Disabilities every year that they give everyone once a year that has all my contact information, what we do, and that I'm out here ready to help if they would like me to.
Yeah, great. So I know that you've done a lot of work with families and done trainings, online trainings for families and individuals with disabilities who live in some of these institutions. What kind of response have you gotten? What are the concerns of family members specifically, and do they differ from the concerns of those individuals who have disabilities?
So a lot of family members, we're told 40, 50, even 60 years ago, you need to put your loved one into a state-operated developmental center and forget about them. They're not going to live very long, and that's where they belong. And so they followed their doctor's advice back then, and that's all that they know, is that their loved one has been in a state-operated developmental center. A lot of them stay involved in their lives, and other people do not stay involved in the lives. It just kind of depends on how their family evolved over time.
So there really are those people who just put them in the institution and try to forget.
Yes, I'm in my upper 50s, and my parents would have been told you need to institutionalize your child because they have developmental disabilities. Remember, back then, they were only given a lifespan of, 30, 40, maybe 50 years. But now we have people with disabilities living as long as you or I do, 60, 70, 80 years old.
Yeah, so you're saying that one of the biggest problems is that people who put their family member in an institutional setting, decades ago, really didn't keep up with other possibilities that may be out there for serving them, right?
That's 100% correct. And then let's just play this out. So every year they're told, well, you could explore a transition to the community if you would like, but they don't know what they don't know, right? So it's like saying, which flavor of ice cream would you like? And you've never had ice cream in your life and you don't know what the flavors are. You have to be educated in understanding what the community is, what a CILA, or a community integrated living arrangement, which is a house just like yours or mine in the community. There are various different levels of care that are in the community and available to people with developmental disabilities, but that does not mean that their family members or even themselves know what those options are or what those options mean.
Yeah, and that was going to be my next question. Do the responses, do the attitudes of the people with disabilities who live in these institutions, are they any different from what their parents or family members might be?
Absolutely. There are many, there are several individuals that say, I don't want to leave the state-operated developmental center, but their family members would like them to explore a more fuller life in the community or back in their own town where their family member lives, or the exact opposite, where they would like to. I run into this scenario more, where the individual themselves would love to come and move out into the community and try getting a job on their own and try living more like you or I in a community of their friends, but that their family member are very nervous about it and don't want them to move out of the institution. And that can be for several reasons. There's several stories of individuals maybe having police interaction because of an aggressive behavior that they had, and that may be why they ended up into an institution. There's lots of several and legitimate reasons why family members are nervous about people moving into the community. But all of those issues can be supported properly in the community, if a plan is put forth.
So let's talk a little bit about the plan. And I know everybody's different in what they need to transition from an institutional setting to a community setting. Can you give an example or two of some of the steps that you found to be most effective in making this a smooth transition?
So one of the steps, I think, is to understand why either the family member and or the individual would like to move into the community. What is it that they want? Do they want their own room? Do they want to exercise choice more, meaning just choosing what they watch on TV or being able to choose what they're having for dinner? Do they want to get back into a community where they have their loved ones and or a boyfriend or girlfriend, and they want to live by them? So I think what's very important is to have wants, needs, and dreams identified for individuals, not only by the individuals but by the family members, and then talk to providers about those wants, dreams, and needs and see if a match can be made. Some people want to go in the community to be able to go to the movie theater and to go out for dinner and to go for walks and to have a little bit more autonomy in their schedule, which is a very difficult thing to do inside of a developmental center.
Extremely.
Because again, it's on the old medical model, and it's based on it's an institution. So think of, for lack of a better word, nursing homes. How many people raise their hand and say, "I can't wait till I'm 60 and I get to live with 60 other people in a nursing home and share my room"? It's not always exactly what we want to do, right?
No, not even close.
Right, exactly.
So what are the barriers that you found for people who are wanting to move out of institutional care into the community?
So just like everywhere else, in fact, some of your news articles were talking about it beforehand, it seems to be a lack of staff. Nationwide, they call it the nationwide hiring crisis. Mm-hmm. And it's still lingering in certain areas. The state of Illinois is still working on getting DSP, or direct service personnel, wages up. And those are the frontline staff that help individuals with their activities of daily living and their lives in the community. And if you don't have a lot of them, you can't fill the bed, meaning a provider can't bring in extra people if they don't have enough staff to take care of the staff that they have. And so that is one barrier that we have run into since COVID. Other barriers are an individual's needs. I mentioned my daughter's needs. My daughter is very medically fragile. She has very high medical needs. That would be a difficult thing for a, perhaps it might be a difficult thing for a provider to take care of in a Stilla's setting, because there's not a whole lot of nursing hours per individual in a Stilla's setting. However, there is other options that maybe fit my daughter a little bit better. So again, I think it, as you said, everybody's stories, wants, and needs are different, and it just takes a lot of digging in and a lot of talking to everybody about how to make all those wants, needs, and dreams actualized, as well as any potential problems that someone might have. As you can imagine, when you transition, it can increase your anxiety. I moved about 10 years ago to another town, and it totally threw me off. I didn't know where anything was. I was very anxious about the move. I was anxious about getting everything done. And, you know, the same type of thing happens to people with developmental disabilities if they have been in a state-operated developmental center for several years, as many as 40 or 50 years, and they move. This is something they've never known, and it can really throw off their game. It can really throw them off. And they, so anticipating what might happen during the transition is a very important thing as well.
Yeah, so I would imagine, too, that people who do transition out of the institutions need a higher level of care, maybe initially, than they would long term. Have you found that to be true?
And that's 100% correct. So what happens in the assessment process of what I'm talking about is they try to anticipate those needs. Maybe somebody is going to need a one-on-one staff for a while to help them get oriented, help them get the attention that they need, and help them get through the day. That might be a support that they get. Maybe it's somebody that wants to access the community more than normal, and so they'll give a little bit more support hours in their what they call rate sheet, but basically the amount of money that the state is willing to give for that individual so that they can be supported in the community doing more activities. It might be that somebody is they anticipate somebody getting very anxious and potentially aggressive with their roommates until they get to know them. And so they might put an extra staff on for that issue. And so, again, it's just trying to get to know the individual, wants, needs, problems, barriers, and trying to make them all work.
Yeah, and is the state being a little bit more sensitive to providing the funding necessary to get that extra help for people who are moving out, or are they pretty much sticking to their formulas?
They do have a formula, but most individuals that come out of state-operated developmental centers do see some enhanced funding, at least for the first year. Also, there's an agency called Equip for Equality, which is an independent monitoring group, and they will follow the individual in their new home monthly for a while when they first come out. The independent service coordinators will increase their visits for the individual when they first come into a Stilla. There's also support teams for behavior and that sort of thing that will be involved in the transition. Again, trying to anticipate and make the transition as smooth as possible. And all of those things I mentioned come along with funding and enhanced services.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so important. And, you know, you and I both have a very personal reason for the work that we do. And I want you to talk a little bit about what you hope for your daughter in the future.
Well, it's really interesting. That's an interesting question. When my daughter was first born, and for most of her life, I wanted her to go, and still would love it, if possible, for her to go into a Stilla and live in the community with her friends and kind of, you know, go off and live her life. I actually own two houses a couple blocks away, and I had one completely handicap accessible and rehabbed so that she could get around. And I envision someday turning that house over to her and her friends, and having either a provider or a co-op inside that, and her being able to live, and I would be a couple blocks away. However, as I mentioned, over the last 5 to 7 years, my daughter has become very medically fragile. Mm-hmm. She needed a kidney. She has spent 9 months in the hospital, home 2 weeks, and then in the hospital 340 days after that. We have spent more time in the hospital than we have at home. She's had over 100 brain surgeries in her life, and she's 30 years old. So I'm talking extremely medically fragile, and right now I have to say I'm not comfortable with her being out of my sight and out of my wife's sight in order to catch all the nuances of her medical condition, because they are subtle, but when they hit, and they hit big.
Yeah, and as we say every show, everybody is very, very different in their, you know, degree of difficulty and the things that they need to live a good life. And I think I applaud you for, you know, spending the time and energy on not only your daughter, but on all these other folks in the state who are really needing your help as well. It's very commendable. I just think you're doing a great job. So if people want more information about the Family Transition Project, let them know how to get a hold of you.
Well, you can go to the Arc of Illinois website and go to the About Us tab, and then scroll down to the Family Transition Project, and that'll have all my information. And you can feel free to contact me with any questions. Myself and my colleagues, we all pass cases around, meaning if I don't know the answer, I can promise you one of them do. And so I will call them and say, hey, can you help me with so-and-so, or can you help me with this problem? We all have very, as you were saying, we all have very similar journeys, but we all have very unique journeys as well.
Absolutely. And what a great staff that you have to work with there at the ARC. And if you're not a member, listener, of the ARC of Illinois, it's not a bad time to think about joining. It's not an expensive membership, and they're doing some of the best advocacy in the country right now. So it is a time for advocacy, and we encourage you to participate as well as everybody else. So thank you so much, Greg, for being on the show. Any last words, anything you forgot to say that you'd like to?
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for having me, but I'd also like to kind of echo what you said. Get involved. Be part of the care team for your loved one, and don't be afraid to stretch your hopes, wants, and dreams for them, because they deserve it just like any other child that you may have.
Well said. Thank you so much, Greg. Greg Walkington, director of the Family Transition Project of the ARC of Illinois. It was a pleasure talking to you, as always.
Thank you.
This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in, and have a great rest of your week.
No, I'll stand my ground. Won't be turned around. Dragging me down, gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down. Pushing me around, but I'll stand my ground, and I won't back down.
Support for WEFT programming is made possible, in part, by the Champaign Park District. The 2024 Box Lunch is back. On select Fridays, talented local artists will fill the historic Springer Cultural Center with a wide variety of music, presented by WEFT. For more information, champaignparks.org.
And you are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Coming up next is Food Sleuth Radio. But before that, I encourage you to go to our website, go to WEFT.